Visit kpft.org to donate your old vehicle to support KPFT. Your contribution is appreciated. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston, kpft.org worldwide.
Welcome to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. My engineer, as usual, is Egberto Willis, who has his own show, Politics Done Right, Thursdays from 3 to 4 p.m. here. Oh, we do all kinds of stuff. We do politics. We do technology. We do, I don't know, we do house buying. We do all kinds of stuff. My guest tonight is going to be Rene Lara. He is the legislative and political director of the Texas AFL-CIO. The Texas AFL-CIO is a federation of public and private sector labor unions in Texas, including affiliates representing teachers, firefighters, plumbers, flight attendants, steel workers, nurses, communications workers, and electrical workers, etc. Labor Day is something that a lot of people celebrate sort of as a barbecue day. And I would like to do something I don't normally do on this show, which is a commentary. And the commentary is about why we celebrate Labor Day. It's now Labor Day night. The day is done. We've all celebrated it after our fashion. Some of us visited friends or shared their barbecues or had our own barbecue. Some of audio. There we go. Some of us went to the beach, maybe for the last time this year. Our kids enjoyed their last long weekend, a faint shadow of their summer vacations before the months of school until Thanksgiving Day. So we all celebrated Labor Day in our fashion, but what is it we were celebrating? Like most national or state holidays, the reason for the holiday gets lost and forgotten. It becomes just the day off, or the long weekend that we're really celebrating. So Washington's birthday, Lincoln's birthday, became President's Day. A day to remember what exactly? Store sales? Memorial Day, Martin Luther King's birthday, Veterans Day. By an act of Congress, these days, once deemed special enough to close the government and our entire financial system, are now just a way of creating long weekends and special shopping days. And so it is with Labor Day. And I'll plead guilty myself. We all take the weekend, cook the food, splash at the beach or whatever, but we never think about why there is a Labor Day. American workers today are often anti-union. The irony is that they're anti-union while working 8-hour days won by unions, 5-day weeks won by unions, getting time and a half for overtime and double time on holidays won by unions, vacation and sick days won by unions, and getting health and retirement benefits won by unions. But trust me, business owners and corporate executives did not award these so-called normal benefits to workers out of the goodness of their hearts, and they didn't give these benefits to workers because some factory worker came hat in hand and asked nicely. History is rife with violence perpetrated against union members by hired thugs, Pinkerton employees, police, and even the U.S. Army. The first American labor unions are said to have been created as early as the late 1700s, but the labor movement started in a big way after the Civil War. Before labor unions in the United States, workers often put in 12 and 18-hour days, sometimes 7 days a week. Industrial accidents, maimings, and deaths were common, though in some industries more than others. Child labor in factories was beyond anything we can imagine now. Elementary school-age children were working in textile mills, standing on wooden boxes for 10 to 12 hours a day so they could reach the controls which operated the machines. Now imagine them breathing in the textile dust and contracting brown lung disease and developing emphysema before they even turn 25. Imagine preteen boys going a mile or more down into coal mines full of explosive coal dust and methane. Imagine thousands of these boys and men being killed each and every year from mine collapses or because there wasn't adequate ventilation to reduce coal dust and methane to safe levels, or because technologies simply focused on production more than safety or health. Nor were women safe from life-threatening exploitation. In 1911, the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire killed 146 garment workers. The company was on the 8th to 10th floors. The workers had been locked in by their managers to prevent theft. Unable to escape the fire, many of those killed leapt 100 feet to their deaths rather than burn to death in the flames. Their bodies covered the sidewalks. The Triangle Shirtwaist Fire, to this day, is still one of the worst industrial disasters in the history of New York City, and it's probably still taught in schools as part of the city's immigrant experience. To many businesses of the time, these weren't truly people. They were simply means to an end. If they were killed or injured, sickened or quit, well, there were plenty more where they came from because there was no such thing as a living wage, and everyone needed the brutal hours of work at any job they could find. The worst part is, and yes, there's a worst part, the worst part is that even the people performing these horrific labors for all these exhausting hours in these dangerous conditions were sometimes cheated at the end by their employers and found their pay envelopes short for reasons contrived by the owners. Workers were sometimes paid in company scrip, good only at the company store. Without cash payments, these workers became nothing more than indentured servants, unable to save enough money to find a better life. In 1955, Tennessee Ernie Ford recorded a song about coal miners and the company store called 16 Tons. Here's a bit of it.
Some people say a man is made out of mud. A poor man's made out of muscle and blood. Muscle and blood and skin and bones. A mind that's weak and a back that's strong. You load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store.
Death, injury, dismemberment, these were all routine costs of doing business to the capitalists of the time. It was left to the families of the dead, ill, and injured to suffer and mourn these traumatic outcomes. The fight for unions that could collectively negotiate with owners really was a fight. It involved paid Pinkerton thugs, police, and even troops. People were killed. Companies went to great lengths, life and death lengths, to prevent unions and union organizers from signing up employees, and workers were known to retaliate in kind. As I've said on this show before, the single purpose of a business is to make money. Balancing that imperative in our society requires other institutions with other purposes. As we know today, one person cannot go to a manager with a grievance without risking their job. The point of a union, then, is to create a balance of power, just like in world diplomacy. That balance needs to be a domestic socio-political triad of labor, government, and business. If any leg of the triad gains too much strength, society suffers. Unions aren't perfect, and businesses can't be held responsible for being what they are meant to be. But as with any negotiation, the fairest outcome is a negotiation between equals. A chief executive of the New Mexico Restaurant Association recently said of a group advocating workers' committees, quote, "We feel that the group's tactics are over the top. I think there are nicer, more effective ways of getting what you want, achieving justice for workers." Seriously? How many business owners have been have given justice to a worker just because the worker said pretty please. Unions give individual workers that equality of negotiating power. The benefits most workers take for granted and enjoy today are the result of at least 150 years of real struggles by American workers to create, organize, and get companies to agree to collectively bargain with unions. And these struggles weren't just paperwork projects fought by blue-collar desk jockeys. One source calls labor union history in America the bloodiest of any industrialized nation on earth. So today, the average working person's job benefits are all considered just the normal stuff by most people. It's always been the way of things in living memory. Workers created Labor Day on their own in 1882. It became a national holiday in 1894 by decree of Grover Cleveland, who decided that May Day was not a good place to put Labor Day because, you know, Haymarket Massacre. On Labor Day and every day, when workers today get the benefits they feel are their normal entitlement, they should remember those benefits weren't free. The same as our national freedom, people fought and died for those benefits. And in the world we live in today, as with our nation's freedom, constant worker vigilance is required to maintain them. I might say, in my opinion, ironically, without the labor advances won by unions, capitalism itself might not exist today. And that's my commentary. So thank you all for being patient and listening. And you are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 FM. I actually have two guests with me tonight. I have Renee Lara, who is the legislative and political director of the Texas AFL-CIO. And I also have Lane Lewis, who is the chair of the Democratic Party of Harris County.
Yes, sir.
And also running for position one at large for the City Council of Houston.
Yes, sir.
And he's just a bonus that hung around after the previous show so that we would have someone else who would like to talk about labor.
Absolutely.
So, Renee, are you with us? Renee.
Yes, can you hear me?
I can hear you now. Yes. Yeah, it sounds so much like a commercial. I guess that commercial just really got it right on. So, Labor Day, unions. You want to touch a little bit on how unions became powerful in the 20th century and what happened after, I guess, the 1970s or 80s that really has cut into their power and influence in organizing American labor?
Well, I think key to the growth of labor unions has been a change in the law. A particular set of laws that enabled union organizing came about through Franklin D. Roosevelt and his labor secretary, Francis Perkins, who rose to prominence because she was motivated, she was shocked, she was present during the fire of the one you just spoke about,
the Triangle Shirtwaist
Factory. She was there in New York City and became the first woman labor secretary. I think the first woman on any presidential cabinet. She helped Franklin D. Roosevelt come through and push through many labor laws, including Social Security for pensioners and retirees. It was the change in the law that was the key that opened the door for organizers to get workers behind, you know, any number of union movements in different industries. And it was a change in the law later that made it more difficult to do so. And I'm talking about the Taft-Hartley law. And after, like, during the 60s, when consultants for corporations figured out that they can use the delays provided for in that law, that then they began to whittle away on the ability of unions to organize. Now, that was one factor. Other things have also impacted union organizing potential, globalization, free trade being one. technology, of course. Union organizing has always, felt the impact of that societal change. And, some say that we are the victims of our own success. Many of our workers have earned a living wage and comfortable retirements. And so through the years, as new workers come along, people have forgotten how they made those gains. And you mentioned the bloody struggles back in the early 1900s.
Yeah, literally bloody. People don't think about it or remember. I actually, just so you know, at thinkwingradio.com, for this show, I have a lot of different links that will take people to pages that talk about the history of unions and union struggles. And some of them are a little divergent. It's kind of interesting how historians or people who write history tend to spin things a little differently. But when you read enough of the pages that are available, you begin to get, like in any news source, you begin to get the true picture. It was really a bloody struggle. People died.
People die nowadays in different parts of the world. So the folks who inherited the jobs through globalization in different parts of the world now are still encountering situations where they work near slave wage levels. And it's the same story all over again. But this time it is a worldwide situation.
I think I read an article several years ago about iron workers, I think it was in Vietnam, that these iron workers were working around red-hot and white-hot iron. They were making manhole covers. And they didn't have protective gear. They didn't have protective shoes. They were working around this sun-level heat, literally surface of the sun-level heat, without any protective gear whatsoever. And this is what's called free trade. Now, there's a distinction between free trade and fair trade, at least in the minds of progressives. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yes. The labor movement is not against trade as a general concept. When trade is used as a means of accessing labor markets that can be exploited, then that becomes unfair trade from our perspective.
All it's doing essentially is exporting work without health insurance, work without environmental protections, work without safety protections. It's just exporting the danger to poorly paid people overseas, and then people here can't get jobs. Now, I think it's important to note, there has been talk about, well, not everybody should get a college degree. And I mean, I don't have a college degree. I was a lousy student. And there are people that can do work that doesn't require a college degree, as many of the jobs that require them don't need college degrees. But manufacturing work, it really is a basis for most average people to support themselves. In my opinion, there's no such thing as a post-industrial economy. An economy has to make stuff. And you need a diverse base of making stuff so that everybody has an opportunity to do what they can do well. And I think that goes back to the so-called free trade versus fair trade argument.
Absolutely. You're getting in, we're talking about the U.S. economy, globalization, lots of big issues. I think as it pertains to the discussion of unions, it is the access to labor that somebody can exploit. It happens. It has happened historically here in the United States. It happens now on a global scale, and it's a very simple concept. Immigration is another form of it. If laborers are brought into the country and not given rights and are not paid a decent wage, that's another form of exploiting workers. And so it's a very basic concept that underlies a whole lot of the issues that we face today.
And I think it's worth noting that, you know, we're not just talking about manual labor like itinerant workers. We're not just talking about day laborers. There are a lot of different sectors of the U.S. economy that import skilled workers from overseas. And I mean, God bless them. Everybody needs to make a living. You know, I don't have anything against that. But they import workers from overseas who are paid well, extravagantly by their home standards, but drive down wages of equally well-trained workers in the United States. They're actually having to compete on our own soil. I don't have anything against people that want to make a living, but when one class of worker is used against another class of worker in order to drive down wages or decrease benefits, that's a perfect example of why you need to have sometimes a closed shop.
Correct. And, yeah, you bring up a good point.
Do we want to talk about closed shop and what that means and what it means in this context?
Well, you know, working in Texas, that is not a common concept.
Precisely.
But what it is you know, in union states where laws allow for that to happen, you are, in essence, you know, the workers are able to prohibit entry into the labor union. A good example would be the Screen Actors Guild.
You have to join the union to do the work.
Join the union, exactly. And if it weren't that way, you would see people in that industry paid a pittance. And as it is, there's a lot of competition for those kinds of jobs, and people aspiring to. Folks who are in a position of being, they could easily be exploited. And so if there weren't that basic level of protection for people who are actors, as an example, I think you would see people being taken advantage of by the big movie studios.
Pro-business, so-called pro-business conservatives argue that closed shops are un-American, that they're oppressive, that they are contrary to the notions of American freedom. And I think a lot of workers have been sold on that idea that closed shops are essentially an anti-American exclusionary concept. What, in fact, is the purpose of a closed shop? Is it to be oppressive? Is it just to protect the union's interests, the executives, the higher-ups of the union? What is the purpose of a closed shop?
A closed shop, just like any other form of issue that is controversial, ends up coming to this basic core concept, and that is the concept of leverage in negotiating. If you can restrict the supply of labor, say in a form of a strike, you can gain a whole lot more leverage than if you didn't. If you are free to, as an individual worker among many thousands of other workers, to try to negotiate with an employer, the balance of power is greatly unequal, and you won't get far.
You have people coming to a place bidding for work at lower wages, driving down everybody's wages.
Correct. So unless you're a superstar, you know, athlete, for example, or a movie star, you can negotiate something on your own. Even then, I think it is difficult. Athletes, professional athletes have unions. But it all comes down to how to obtain leverage. And on the employer side, they try to, you know, it's in their best interest for purposes of making a profit to get rid of the ability of workers to have more leverage, and so they try to take that away. And the concept of, you know, freedom to, you know, work, you know, in the argument they use is simply a smokescreen to push through a, you know, the idea that workers ought not to have any leverage.
So-called right to work laws.
Correct. So no collective bargaining, no joining together, no closed shop, ability to, you know, so any number of things related to labor eventually get down to the concept of whether or not you can leverage yourself into a negotiating position where you can ask for higher wages,
you know,
better benefits.
One of the things that has fascinated me is over the years, I've come to the conclusion that one of the reasons that businesses are so afraid of unions, it seems to me they don't negotiate with them very well. Unless one of two circumstances exists, where you have union officials negotiating truly in good faith, understanding that workers have to make a living and employers have to make a living, have to make a profit. You sometimes get a situation where the union is so aggressive and the labor force is so essential to the survival of the business that management sometimes comes to a point where they'll agree to almost anything. And then down the road, it turns out that they made a really bad deal because they just don't seem on some level. It's almost like they don't teach this in business school. How do you collectively bargain with a union and create a true win-win situation? And it doesn't seem like a lot of businesses know how to do that.
Who knows where the culture of, anti-union capitalism originates. We know that there are model countries like Germany where the labor unions and the shareholders of companies get along pretty well, and management and unions are able to provide for higher wages. And so we know it's possible. But you're right, here in America, we've had a different type of evolution of thought in that regard. And it may be that political leaders have used the anti-labor culture for their own purposes. And there's consultants now, you know, there have been for a long time, who make a living off of fighting unions, undermining them, sabotaging them. The Pinkerton security company, way back when, you know, encouraged that kind of thing, and led to some of the violence that you mentioned earlier. So there are vested interests in avoiding a situation where workers and management work well. And sometimes, you know, you never know. Historically, every situation, there definitely is a culture of that. And in Texas, it's deeply embedded. It has been around for a long time. Who knows? Maybe that's what happens at country clubs. You know, people talk about union bashing.
Okay. Let me do a quick station ID. Then I'm going to give our surprise guest, Lane Lewis, an opportunity to comment a little bit on what we've discussed. And Max is waiting on the phone. I haven't given out a phone number, but I do want to get Max on. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, your community radio station. Please support us. My engineer is Egberto Willis. He has his own show, Politics Done Right, Thursdays from 3 to 4 p.m. And my guest today is Rene Lara. He is the legislative and political director at the Texas AFL-CIO, which is a federation of many different labor unions. So, Lane, you've been sitting here through a lot of this discussion. I've been seeing you taking a lot of notes, hopefully notes that is like, wow, that's really impressive thinking. So what do you think of the state of unions today? I know running for city council, you have tried to get support from both business groups and labor groups. Mm-hmm. That's a tightrope to walk.
It is.
What are your thoughts on the current situation with labor and management and collective bargaining, specifically in Houston and Texas generally, and specifically in the United States overall?
Well, let me speak first. I'm very proud. As you said, I'm running for city council position one, and I have received the endorsement of just about every union in town, including AFL-CIO, so local here, so I appreciate that. but from the party perspective, the party has been, the Democratic Party certainly supports labor, and labor has traditionally supported the Democratic Party, and I can give you a most recent example. When the steelworkers, USW, was on strike earlier this year, February, March, April, it went on a little longer than I think any of us expected. and reached out to Lee Medley, reached out to Joshua Leger, and said, what do you guys need? And they were really quite honest. They said, our food pantry has run out. And we have families who have babies that need milk and diapers and food. And so the Democratic Party, as county chair, I put out a call for action, and we raised about $3,000, and we got Kroger cards for all the families that needed it. And I'm very proud of the work that the Democratic Party did for those families, very much so. But you're right. It is a delicate balance, and I think you really hit the nail on the head in that how do we come together in a way that is a mutually benefit.
Yeah,
right?
We don't want labor to put business out of business, and we don't want business to starve labor. So it has to be a win-win. Any
Absolutely.
Good negotiation has a little pain for both sides, but everybody comes out ahead.
Absolutely. And that's the key. And when I talk to these business groups as well as the labor groups, I'm up front with the business owners because, of course, they see that I have all these endorsements from labor, and it causes the business groups to pause a little bit before endorsing me for city council. So far they have.
Natural antagonism.
And what I say is, look, guys, a lot of these folks are doing work that none of you would want your parents or your children or your grandkids to do for the wages that you pay. They want to have a good diet. They want to go to a good school. They want to go to college. We also understand that if you go out of business, they're all out of jobs. So we've got to find a way to make you a profitable company while your employees are able to make at least livable wages, but preferably savable wages. That's usually what I talk about, savable wages. It's not enough just to live on them.
Not a living wage, but a saving wage.
Exactly.
And I think that we've kind of lost track of the fact that the real job creators, I mean, I know that a lot of liberals say this, but really business people need to take this to heart. Job creators are consumers. People with money won't create jobs unless there is demand. The demand comes before the jobs. Henry Ford, for all his bad personality defects, the one thing he understood is that his workers should be his best customers. His workers should be able to afford what it is they are building. And there are statistics that go back 100 years that show that when you have well-paid workers, and I have to say it's predominantly in Democratic and progressive administrations, when you have well-paid workers, tax rates are higher on the rich, but they end up netting more money. It's a counterintuitive thing. I can totally understand why rich people don't understand that higher taxes can actually lead to them making more money. But when you have spending on infrastructure and you have workers getting paid to do that infrastructure, and then they buy stuff from the people paying the taxes, and it's a win-win. And somehow we have lost sight of that.
There's a local artist named Jay Brannon. He doesn't live here any longer, but he's from Katy. He's got three or four very good CDs. I highly recommend them. One of the songs that he has is called American Idol. There's a line in the song that says, wiping down menus of food I can't afford.
I like that.
And it goes to your point, wiping down menus of food that I cannot afford.
If you can't afford to buy stuff, then ultimately your employer suffers. You know, going back to, you were talking about the SEIU and the janitors union and the building owners, to me, and sometimes it's a stretch because it's like a 6 degrees of separation thing, but if you're paying your janitors a saving wage, they become better customers, if not of your building, of the people in your building, which means that those people end up perhaps paying higher rents because the demand is there for the space, or they end up making more money so they can pay their employees better so that those employees can be better customers for other places. We talk a lot about vicious cycles. There is also such a thing that we don't talk about much called a virtuous cycle. The virtuous cycle is the exact opposite. Instead of spiraling down into a point where you cannot see an end, the virtuous cycle is what happens during an economic recovery, where you end up hiring people who then make money, who then spend money, who then create demand, so that now there are more jobs of people who make money, who spend money, etc. That is a virtuous cycle. We never hear about that part of it, but that's true.
Well, and speaking to your point, and believe it or not, There's 70% of the city that does not generate enough tax revenue in order to pay for the services that the city provides. That means that, for all intents and purposes, 30% of the city is carrying the burden of providing services for the rest of us. And why is that? Because, going to your point, they're not earning enough to pay enough taxes to pay for the services that they're providing. We need to be looking at opportunity. How do you create demand in neighborhoods that aren't producing as much tax revenue as they could if we were lifting all boats?
And you make an interesting point, an essential point, when you say they don't pay enough taxes. There is nobody on the soil of the United States who pays no taxes. Illegal immigrants pay taxes, whether it's gas taxes or sales taxes or property taxes in some cases or license fees. Everybody pays taxes. What we're talking about is Romney's 47% conundrum, where 40% of the population, more or less, doesn't make enough money to pay income taxes. So here's the thing. If we paid people more money so that they started to fall into the lower levels of income taxpayers, then government revenue would go up, debt would go down, and we would still have more taxpayers helping to divide the cost of government.
Exactly. Lifting all boats.
You know, we're not even staying even, where it is minimum wage workers are making less money in terms of purchasing power than they did in the 1960s. And so what, in essence, what's been happening is there's been a loss of purchasing power, meaning that workers have been getting wage cuts every year that inflation has eaten up that purchasing power.
Well, a couple of quick points. I've heard that if you took inflation into account, the minimum wage, if it was indexed now, would be like $22 an hour. I would also point out that Nick Hanauer, who gave a great TED talk, he was an early investor in Amazon, and he has made the point, you know, he's an incredibly rich guy. He makes 100 times what almost anybody in the audience makes, maybe 1,000 times. But he can't buy enough cars. He can't buy enough clothes. He can't buy enough houses to support the economy by himself with all that money. There has to be a recirculating system so that everybody gets a chance to spend and collect money.
Yeah. There's only so many boats you can buy.
Only so many. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Even yachts. There are only so many yachts you can buy.
Trickle down. I think we know that doesn't work.
I think that the first one to say it was JFK, who said that a rising tide lifts all boats. And that is the economic philosophy we need, not this trickle-down stuff. Mm-hmm. Trickle-down is like in the movie Sahara, where they find this well where the water is just trickling, and they're trying to collect drops of water. That's trickle-down. Rising tide floating all the boats is what makes the economy work. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 FM. My guest, my primary guest here, pardon me, Lane, is Renee Lara. Lane was here in the studio, and I thought he would make an interesting counterpoint because he does deal a lot in local union activity. And I have Max on the line, so I'm going to give Max a chance to make his points and perhaps if he has questions he would like to ask. Max, you're on the air.
Tongue in cheek, I am the son of a carpenter. My dad was a member of the Houston local. We lived in Sealy. He had a philosophy of never having the problem that a rich man was going to have of getting into heaven, like a camel passing through the eye of a needle. His highest gross income per year was never more than $3,000. And he and Mom, she kept a huge garden, raised 8 of us. We're of Moravian descent. My great-grandfather came to Texas from Moravia.
Moravia is like around Romania?
No, one of the provinces of Czechoslovakia.
I see. Okay.
And a little aside, as best as I can figure, and Dr. Storyteller, his last name is not entering my mind right now, and I are working on a project to find out where Edward Beneš got the name Czech for Czech. Czechoslovakia. Okay, that's a aside. Back to our problem here with the union.
Yeah.
It's unfortunate that this country came to unionization from the adversarial side rather than from the co-op.
Well, I think it always came from the adversarial side. Even in Europe, where there wasn't, as I understand it, quite so much violence, it was a very unpopular concept. I mean, capitalists, business people, I'm sympathetic. My mom, my stepfather, my dad, going back a couple of generations, have all been business owners. And no one likes to give up money. They're working hard. It's like, I'm making a great profit. Why should I give it to you? And, you know, I have a saying that you start off being the boss you always wanted and you end up being the boss you always had. Because people take advantage of you and it becomes tiresome and it really taxes your natural good nature.
Okay, let's turn to China rather than Europe.
Okay.
In the 60s, every year we used to visit Scott and Helen Nearing in Harborside, Maine, where they moved from Jamaica, Vermont, in the 50s. In the 30s, they moved from New York to Jamaica, Vermont, to start the Back to the Earth farming movement. They were the pioneers.
Max, I have to ask you, we're kind of talking about labor and unions, and I think you're drifting off the point a little bit.
Okay, no, I'm not. In China, I read a book in the 60s called Fan Shen, and at a meeting with Elliot Coleman, another farmer, progressive guy that was a friend of the Nearings, in the 60s, I raised the issue that I read in Fan Shen. It turns out that in China, there's a history, thousands of year history, of local organization controlling what happens locally.
But that isn't necessarily the same as a union. I mean, essentially what you had was chiefs and strong men and community leaders, but it wasn't necessarily a community thing.
It played a role in life. Tip O'Neill said, all politics is local.
True enough.
Okay. That's what is happening in China today. Why is it that China has gotten where it's at? It's because of this local cooperative spirit that involves workers, it involves people, it involves who got hurt and who gets help, and they decide this at an exhaustingly detailed community-level politics.
Max, I'm going to have to let you go. I've got a couple of other callers waiting on the line, but I appreciate your calling.
It's an important point for us to transition from adversarial union ownership to cooperative barn raising. We should go to co-ops instead of corporations.
I agree. I think that's a great note to end it on. Thank you for calling, Max. I appreciate it very much. Let me do a quick ID. You're listening to Think Wing Radio on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, your community radio station. Please go to kpft.org and hit the tip jar and contribute to the station and the transmitter. Just putting in a little plug there. My guests today are Rene Lara of the Texas AFL-CIO. He's the legislative and political director. And my surprise guest is Lane Lewis, chairman of the Harris County Democratic Party and also running for
City Council position one at large
is the term I was trying to come up with. Okay, Joshua is our next caller. Joshua, you're on the air. How you doing tonight?
How y'all doing tonight? I'm doing real good.
Good.
Working out here in Houston. I wanted just to bring up, I don't think I've heard anybody talk about it, but we had a really big National Labor Board win, I think, for labor when you look at how they're going to look at companies. And they haven't done this post-1980, and that's actually to look at them as even as subcontractors. They have some control on them.
Yes.
Are y'all aware of this?
Actually, I've heard about this, that, okay. You know, what is the distinction between an employee and a contractor? And companies, for many, many years, have played fast and loose with that.
Hugely. And I think it's set workers back and organized workers profusely. Because if you look, guys, at how many workers now are subcontractors, let's say the old worker strike that just happened about a few months ago, you know, we're still trying to get over that. If you look at that, then we started taking steps to talk about contractors and how many had proliferated our refineries. And this is, I think, another step towards that, that we're getting a nod from them that this has obviously gone on for too long, that there's been too much fast and loose playing in the community or in the corporate centers with it. Do you think, and I'm asking Lane and the rest of them, this is going to be a good thing for Houston, or do they think it's going to be something we're going to have to continue fighting down the road because they're not going to give up the ability to do this?
Renee, I think that's a great question for you to start on as someone who's actually working in the Texas AFL-CIO. What are your thoughts on this contractor conundrum?
Are we talking about misclassified employees?
I think essentially that's what we're talking about, people that are – people that work pretty much exclusively for a company, and yet they're not considered employees by the company, so they don't have to pay benefits, they have to pay their own medical insurance, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, we see this in different industries. FedEx, for example, had a big issue related to that. And in fact, I think that they're the reason there was an LRB board decision.
National Labor Relations Board.
Yes, correct. And you know, it happens, I think Uber is in a similar situation.
Yes.
People trying to, the company is identifying their workers as independent contractors when in fact they're acting more like employees who follow the direction of the employer, and there's a set definition of what employer is. I'm not sure there's another issue relating to contractors, and that's when someone is brought in to do certain jobs in, for example, oil refineries.
Actually, a great example is cable television. A lot of the contractors for Comcast and AT&T are considered contract installers. So they may drive a company-labeled vehicle, but they're basically paying for their own tools, and they pay their own insurance, and they're self-insured in terms of their Social Security. But they're considered contractors, but all they do is install cable.
Joshua, are you still on the line?
Yes, sir.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't there an issue of safety when the USW was on strike and it went on for quite some time? They were bringing in these contractors that could kind of do the job, but they didn't exactly have 20 years of experience. And so there were some real safety concerns, if I remember correctly, at some of these plants out there.
It's really a twofold problem, because when we were on strike, that was one of the biggest questions we had. You didn't have the guys with the time, the tools, and the experience in there working on the equipment. Secondly, we were trying to fight and say, look, some of these guys have been here for 10, 20 years plus, and mm-hmm. they aren't your regular maintenance workers. Mm-hmm. So you're going to lose that experience if they jump to another job that makes more money. Mm-hmm. You're not retaining. So there was a twofold problem. We were working on the issue for long-term employees that were contractors, as well as though we're bringing in even more inexperienced workers who had not worked with the equipment as long as we had during that strike time. So there was a real worry and angst, I think, in the industry.
One of the things I have found about companies generally is how little they value institutional knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think you see this all over. You're always letting go the older, more experienced guy for the younger, cheaper guy who doesn't know how to use all the tools available to do his job. At NASA, because of the wax and wane of funding, there are things that NASA used to do now that nobody knows how to replicate. You know, they've had to go back and reverse engineer the Saturn V because, I mean, they're not going to rebuild the Saturn mm-hmm. V, but they've had to reverse engineer it in order to build the new launch system, because there was nobody around who really remembered the details, the fine details, material specifications and such. And even the blueprints were lost.
Oh, man.
I mean, they really had to dig for the blueprints for the Saturn V. So we're talking a $24 billion program to develop this rocket in 1960s dollars today would be like $250 billion. And they didn't value the institutional knowledge enough to make sure it was handed off properly to the next generation. And that seems to be a continuing issue in all businesses. You know, you hear it. I hear this all the time, like in the science community, when people say, I'm at the peak of my career. Why is it that they're hiring somebody else? If you think about it, the very term saying you're at the peak means there's no place to go up. Every place around you is down. It's a real conundrum, and I don't know why business is so willing to let go of institutional knowledge like that. They value it so lightly.
That's a millennial problem, too, because I'm sure everyone is aware, even unionization rates have come down, as well as that pass-off of information isn't occurring because there's not a lot of unions out there working with each other. This is, I guess, my opinion more. But we're not working with each other to pass that knowledge on, and that's going to leave us in a really bad spot pretty soon if we don't pick up the pace and learn what we can from some of those people who just can't retire at this point, and they're waiting for in the wings right now for us to come in into the workforce and learn from them.
And, you know, actually, you bring up a point that I wanted to touch on. There was an article in the New York Times from September 6th called Workers Organize But Don't Unionize to Get Protection Under Labor Law. And essentially, they're talking about people in New Mexico, low-wage workers in New Mexico, who are being exploited by their employers. And rather than form unions, which becomes a legally very challenging thing to do in any company, let alone a right-to-work state, they are forming what are called workers' committees, which apparently has been a little-used part of the National Labor Relations Act. Renee, are you familiar with that?
No, not. I mean, I've heard of it, and it looks like these are. You know, we work very closely with the Workers' Defense Project, which is a nonprofit 501c3 organization that is not a union, that advocates for mostly immigrant workers in construction projects. I know there's a office in Dallas, and there may be one in Houston as well. And this is a different organizational approach for the very reason you just mentioned is it's very difficult to start a union through the regular traditional channels. And another way to organize people, I believe that this is what the organizers are trying. There's some legal challenges for that, though. You don't have some of the protections you would if you were going through the regular traditional.
It's not as good as a union, but for many workers, it's better than nothing. And
exactly.
This really leads me to one of the points that I kind of wanted to get to near the close. And Jerry, I'm going to try to get to you before the end. I'm not going to swear. I think one of the real questions here is if we're moving into a different kind of organizational labor framework, if the current state legal situation makes it so hard to unionize that now we're trying to find alternative ways of protecting workers' rights, it leads to a real issue because unions have been helping a lot of these organizations and yet are not generating any revenue from it. And let's be plain, unions need money to run just like any other enterprise. You've got people like you, Renee, who work basically full-time doing this. This is your job, and you have to make a living at it and feed your family while you're advocating for workers. You've got officials in unions that have to be paid full-time. You have to have strike funds that are built up. That money has to come from somewhere. You have to do advocacy of laws to protect workers, and the money to accomplish that, the travel, the time to take away, all the different expenses involved in trying to get legislation passed. All of this comes down to money. So if we're moving into what might look, at least for the time being, maybe for the next decade or more, into a new kind of labor organizational framework, how do traditional unions survive in that environment, Renee?
Well, there was a point in U.S. history where there were virtually no unions.
True.
So prior to 1931, during the in the 20s, there were very the, you know, the number of union members is very, very low density. But you bring up a very interesting issue, and that is, where will unions go from here? There are direct attacks. Currently, we, during the last legislative session, experienced attacks on the ability of public employees to raise money through and collect dues. So the other side definitely knows what could hurt unions. Society has changed, however, rapidly, and the way people even communicate is different. So the way commerce is being done, how money is transmitted back and forth through, you know, the internet, it's a world that could be, open up a different avenue of union organizing and union funding. Or funding of efforts similar to what unions do.
I have a suspicion that this is going to be the biggest challenge facing traditional unions, is how to survive financially and physically in this new proto-organizing environment. I'm going to let Jerry get on the line really quick. Joshua, thank you so much for calling. I appreciate it.
Real quick on that one.
Yes, sir.
We're going back to the drawing board, and we're going to make sure that unions stay around, if not get stronger again. And a lot of it is, like he said, is trying to reach new members and also communicate with our existing members that are getting younger, that are in their 30s. And that's the biggest key for us moving forward in organizing new places. And
well, Joshua, again, I appreciate your call. And as these things move forward, I would appreciate your calling in from time to time and keeping me posted. Thanks so much for calling. Jerry, I'm going to give you a minute. You're going to have to be very succinct.
Okay. Well, just a couple of points in here quickly. You know, one of the things that gets me, you guys are talking about that, and somebody mentioned China. The real problem, when this is going to really become sensitive for a lot of people, is about 2018, when China's supposed to reach purchasing power parity with the United States, supposedly. And people are going to start noticing, and there are people who are going to be pretty upset. My guess is that, you know, how is it that they do so well and we don't? And, you know, and a bunch of their people are getting ahead, and, you know, a bunch of our people are not getting ahead.
As someone who has been to China, I will tell you, Jerry, that to call it a communist country is a complete misnomer at this point. You've got an authoritarian communist party, but you've got a country with fewer wage protections than the United States, fewer health protections than the United States, a poor, I mean...
I know that, but I mean, I'm just saying, though, that...
Hold on, Jerry, I'm going to have to let you go. It's late. And, thanks, you know, so much for calling. Take care.
All right, bye-bye.
Renee, you had something you wanted to...
Well, the caller said that China was going to reach parity with the United States in terms of wage earning power, and that's simply not the case. They're so far behind. I think you mentioned some of the wage levels earlier on in the show.
Yeah, I mean,
they
It's not a comparable situation. Thank you so much for our callers. Thank you, Renee Lara, for taking the time on Labor Day night to speak with us. And, of course, thank you to Lane Lewis, our surprise guest, running for City Council Position 1 at large and the chair of the Harris County Democratic Party. Everybody have a great night. Take care.
Hi, I'm Molly Stenz, news director at WORT-FM in Madison, Wisconsin. I'm also a KPFT donor. Are you? KPFT is such an important station. It's a bright, shining star in the constellation of independent grassroots stations across the country. Stations that support your right to free speech. We can keep KPFT strong and free for everyone. You can help. This fall, KPFT is holding its fall fund drive. Let's kick it off with a bang. Pledge now at kpft.org. And thanks from all of us all over the country who listen to KPFT.
One in nine Americans listens to a local public radio station on a regular basis. Many use stations like KPFT to make voting decisions, music choices, their own conclusions about the world, or where to go over the weekend. That's because less than 0.5% of programming on commercial stations goes to local public affairs. Why not consider supporting KPFT as a major donor? Whether as an individual or an organization, major donors help KPFT in many ways. Major donors help big station projects and ensure KPFT gets the money it needs to survive without all those pledge drives. Just call our development director at 713-526-4000 to become a major donor today. Your donation of $5,000 or more helps keep independent arts, music, news, and views alive and kicking on the Gulf Coast. Become a KPFT major donor today. Call our development director at 713-526-4000 to